We're all concerned with the high cost of aviation fuel, but what are the costs of not flying? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller. Bob is a certified flight instructor based in the Buffalo area, and he also is the publisher of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which you can find on the internet at overtheairwaves.com. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Paul.
In your Over the Airwaves for July, which just came out a few days ago, you had a very interesting, very timely piece on the cost of fuel. And I know that, you know, you can't go to a pilot's lounge now without hearing this discussed, because it's really the top topic. And there are some areas of the country here where avgas is now $7 a gallon or more. You brought up something that's very interesting, because when I look around my neighborhood today, it's filled with houses that were built mainly after 1990. And you see 2 and 3 car garages, and you see evidence of lifestyles that are very different from what our parents had 40 or 50 years ago. And you pointed out that maybe if we lived the way they did, with, you know, giving up the second car and having more modest homes and that sort of thing, we would have the money for some of the discretionary purchases we want to make, including flying.
Well, that's certainly true. I understood or heard recently that the average American family spends about 3% of its income on fuel and about 15% of its income on food. And some of the pundits were suggesting that we could mitigate the cost of fuel by cutting back our expenses on food. Not necessarily eating less food, but eating lesser cut or quality cut meats, eating less meat, eating out at restaurants less frequently, becoming our own butcher and things like that. The same is true with all aspects of our daily living. Sure, fuel prices are going up, and it's a sacrifice for most of us. But surprisingly enough, if we want to have the fuel costs that we had in the 50s, as you said, we can begin living like we did in the 50s and save money in other areas in order to continue flying.
Well, I remember reading at one point a few years ago an alarming statistic which said that the average fuel economy of the cars driven on the American roads doubled. In other words, you know, it was very common in the past for cars to get 10 to 14 miles per gallon back in the day when large V8s still roamed the earth. And the average fuel economy of the fleet roughly doubled. And at the same period of time, the number of miles driven roughly doubled. So, you know, we're kind of backpedaling here. I think there are a lot of ways where if we really looked around, we would recognize that it's a matter of priorities, not a matter of absolutes.
Well, yes, and you know, flying for most of us is an option. It's a recreation. It's a choice or a decision that we make, and we can decide not to fly or fly, unlike a lot of other expenses that we have where we really have no choice. In the automobile, of course, we have to get to work. We have to get to the store. We have to run our errands. Sure, there are ways that we can cut back that, but flying still for most of us represents an optional endeavor. But I think a point that really needs to be made is the false economy resulting from perhaps cutting back our flying. As we cut back our flying due to fuel costs, we're also cutting back dramatically on our proficiency. We know from a safety perspective that the greatest benefit to proficiency comes from frequent flying. And should we fall into the trap of that false economy by saying, well, I'm not going to fly this month because of fuel costs, we could, in fact, be increasing our risk for a very major expense down the road as a result from a simple accident or mishap, a bent landing gear, a damaged wing on landing. And that's something I think we all really need to think about.
Well, the other thing, too, is that your fixed expenses for the aircraft go up per hour on a per hour basis if you don't fly as much. For example,
that is perhaps the biggest, when you have an airplane that has a fixed expense just for hangar, say $250 a month, you know, we're looking at $3,000 a year for that hangar. And if we only fly 10 hours in a given year, do the math, that's $350 an hour in expenses for less frequent flying.
Oh, sure. And the annual, you know, you're going to have to get that done annually. That's what it says. It doesn't say, you know, every 50 hours. This is annually. So things like that go up. A related topic, Bob, was you had mentioned that some of the great places to go for a $100 hamburger or $200 or whatever it works out to now are starting to dry up, that some diners are closing in your area at airports that that are kind of sad. It's going to be one more recreational destination that doesn't exist.
Well, this is we use in our flight school airports with restaurants nearby or on field for a lot of our ground training. It makes the ground training more interesting. It makes the flight more interesting rather than doing ground training back at the FBO or in the flight school classroom. And it certainly is convenient to do this over a cup of coffee or a glass of Pepsi. And we're finding fewer and fewer airports in this area that have nearby restaurants or on-field restaurants. And it's a tragedy. And there's lots of reasons why these close. But my recommendation in the piece on Over the Airways is, let's try to support these declining facilities. Let's go out there and make an intent to buy a meal and support your favorite local airport diner.
When I was living in Oregon at the Salem, Oregon Airport, McNary Field, there is a great little restaurant that has an entrance for people who want to drive up on one side of the chain link fence and an entrance for the pilots to come in from the ramp on the other side. And what I figured out when I got there was that there were times when it was mostly pilots who were eating there. But at other times, it was clear that there were, you know, people who'd brought their kids out just to be able to enjoy an early lunch and look out over the airport and watch the little planes come and go. I guess it may just be as simple a matter for some of these places as putting a door on the non-pilot side to get a little extra business in.
Well, absolutely, and this is a great way, of course, to promote general aviation. Ocean City, New Jersey, is a classic facility that just similar to what you've just described. On a Sunday morning, it's tough to get a seat in there because they are catering to the public. But there's things that restaurants can do, airport restaurants can do, of course, to promote it. But it's so sad when we find a destination that no longer has that airport cafe. And I think some of this can be mitigated by we pilots going over there and supporting, as I said earlier, these facilities.
All right. We're going to talk in a moment about pilots running out of fuel and why do experienced pilots run out of fuel. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plath. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves for our weekly chat on safety issues. Bob, one of the things you wrote about in the July issue of OTA was the fact that we're still running out of fuel at a rate that makes you just shake your head when you read the reports. Why do experienced pilots run out of fuel?
I think it comes down to one of two possible explanations. One, it's either a judgment lapse where for some reason or another we assume because we've never run out of fuel before, we're not likely to run out again. It's just an oversight on the part of the pilot or the instructor. The other possible explanation is tempting fate. Just believing that they can stretch those last few miles out of a tank of gas. But the point you made is valid. We suffer one major fuel mismanagement accident, a significant accident, once every 4 days. And that is a result of any number of factors. But the fact remains is it should simply not happen. Running out of fuel is something that is simply a management problem that the pilot has either, as I said before, tempted fate or just simply neglected to consider it.
Well, the example you mentioned, I think, was a Cessna 172 where an experienced instructor, very experienced instructor, went up with a student and only had 12 gallons in the plane for what they knew would be more than an hour's worth of flying, which, you know, right off the top of your head, even if you don't have the pilot's operating handbook in front of you for that plane, looks kind of suspect. And I wondered, because when I was training, I know there were times in the Iraqi Champs where when we were going to have two 200-pound guys flying around for a while, we had to really kind of plan missions carefully, especially in the summer, for density altitude. You know, that plane didn't have a whole lot of power, and we wanted to make sure we could safely climb out. And I wonder if the cost of fuel or these DA factors, things like that, are part of it. Do we just not think these things through carefully? I know a Cessna 172, if you fill it up with four people and fuel, you'll be overweight.
Yes, and airline pilots have been complaining bitterly of late because airline management now is planning fuel loads for their aircraft that enable them just to get to their destination with barely legal minimums in order to lighten the weight of the airplane, therefore burn less fuel. But airline dispatch offices, airline planning offices have a lot more going for them in terms of being able to assess accurately what the fuel load is going to be than many of us GA pilots. We're not working with the same performance tables operated at the same level of preciseness that transport category airplanes are operating at. We need to have those reserves and frankly, to offload fuel to carry that extra passenger does require, as you pointed out, very, very careful planning to ensure that we have enough to make our destination and an alternate as required by the FARs.
Well, and when was the last time you heard about an airliner running out of fuel?
It has happened. I mean, there was a classic case, Avianca, over Long Island back in the early 70s, I believe it was. I think it was a Boeing 707 where he was just constantly being diverted and diverted, trying to get into JFK and failed to advise ATC of a low fuel advisory, and which eventually became a low fuel emergency. And that's another issue, and I think that's a point worth taking, that if we are in a situation where fuel is critical, we have to make it clear to ATC that we have a low fuel advisory, particularly when operating on an IFR flight plan. Let me just make a comment that's seemingly unrelated, but I served a year in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and any time there was an injury or illness, the military took full responsibility for the soldier, for their care and recovery and whatnot, in all cases except sunburn. Sunburn was viewed by the military as so obviously preventable that if we were incapacitated due to sunburn in Vietnam, it was considered a line of duty no determination. In other words, that time off was going to be taken from our leave time. I look at fuel and fuel emergencies in the same context as sunburn. These are so preventable. If we do run out of fuel, it's no different than simply staying out in the sun too long without sun protection. It is it's a pilot error, any way you slice it, unless there was a mechanical problem, a ruptured tank en route, something like that.
Well, I like your analogy because every time I've been sunburned, if I think back, I know it ran through my mind at the beginning of the day, and I just decided to go without the sunscreen.
Yeah, it's incredibly preventable. It doesn't mean we have to stay out of the sun, but yeah, there are steps that we can take. And same with fuel management. This is, and I'm not speaking from a holier-than-thou perspective. I've looked at flights that I've taken in the past and second-guessed my own judgment, situations where I got into a low-fuel situation and knew full well at the time, and in retrospect, certainly, that was preventable just simply by better fuel planning or making an inward stop for fuel.
All right. Well, Bob, as always, we appreciate your insights, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Paul.
You can find a link to Bob Miller's writings on Over the Airwaves at overtheairwaves.com, and you'll also find a link there to Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated. Bob Miller has been my guest, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.